2000 on Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 162, J. Golden Kimball and the Financial Panic of 1893. Participants James N. Kimball and Edward Leo Lyman.
Time is 3:30. It's time to begin this session. This will be session number 162. J. Golden Kimball and the Financial Panic of 1893. Our participants on today's program are James Kimball, his fame has preceded him in various formats, he'll be speaking about some aspects of J. Golden Kimball that some of us may not have been aware of. So in that regard, it may be a little bit like that radio program, you know, the rest of the story. Here's the other side of J. Golden Kimball you may not have heard. My name is Tom Parks. I've been asked to chair this session. And other than that, you will not hear much from me, except if we have some question and answer periods afterward. The other participant who just walked in, to my great relief, is Leo Lyman, who is the author of that wonderful tome on political deliverance and the Mormon quest for Utah statehood. And he'll be commenting. If there's time remaining after these two speakers, then we'll entertain questions from the audience. And so with that, Brother Kimball.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to take my coat off, if you don't mind. Let me begin by saying... this room is much cooler than the other one, so we're lucky. Yeah, fewer people. And that's my fault. That's if I'd have written a really interesting paper. But I'll give you some Golden Kimball stories you've never heard before, so you can have some distinct advantage for having come. Let me just tell you a little bit about searching for the true identity of J. Golden Kimball has been something I've been pursuing for years. And I have written two papers that will eventually end up in a book that I hope to have out next spring, titled Remembering Uncle Golden. The first paper was on his personal life, his family, his children. And it was a very interesting exposure to a lot of the heartache in his life that came from his family. Primarily, that heartache sprang from his assignments as a member of the First Quorum of 70, which took him to the far reaches of the church in the United States and Canada and Mexico. The other thing was a rebellious tendency that developed in his children to the church and to both parents. I have such children in my family, so I understand. Maybe many of you do. They are free-spirited, and we believe in free agency. The thing you never want to do, I've decided, is ever close the door. They might well come back. But the second paper was on Uncle Golden's financial problems, and they were many. He struggled all his life to pay his bills and to meet his financial obligations. And the financial crisis of 1893 only carried him further into debt until he finally had to declare bankruptcy. The last general authority, by the way, to ever declare bankruptcy. After that, they made sure no one went through that kind of a trauma. And so I say in this paper, somewhere into the second page, that I have shown in several hundred performances around the country and around the world the lighter side of Uncle Golden, and it has been rewarding for me to see these other aspects because of the great respect and esteem I have developed for him because of what he had to deal with in his personal life. To stand at a pulpit and to have the audience be amused by his comments and his light repartee, and to evidence his delightful wit continuously and have them feel a oneness with him is to me an evidence of great strength in the face of a lot of personal and financial crises. So let me proceed. Speaking in April 1975, General Conference, Spencer W. Kimball told this story about Jay Golden, prefacing it with his comment, "I don't think it is true." Cousin Spencer often did this. He would tell a story at a Kimball family reunion, and he'd always preface it by, "I don't think this is true." Maybe that was a safeguard in case someone confronted him back in a quorum meeting. Why would you tell that story? And you could always fall back on that. Well, I never thought it was true, and so it's all right to tell it. But I think this story is true. I find most of the stories that I have been told of him to be true. It was said of him, this is Spencer Kimball speaking, it was said of him that his creditors kept coming and bothering him all the time, and they wanted payment when they wanted payment on their accounts. And he began to get a little tired of it, and he said to them, "Now listen, fellows," I'll do it in his real voice, "Now listen, fellows, you know the way I handle my accounts. I take all my bills at the end of the month and I put them in the wastebasket. Then I stir them around and see one that looks good and I think I can pay it and I take it out. But," he says, "if you keep bothering me, I won't even put yours in the wastebasket." This is a funny story, but in reality, it was far less humorous. In this paper, I will examine the far-reaching impact of the Panic of 1893, both on the LDS Church and on the personal finances of Uncle Golden. The Panic of 1893 and the subsequent downward spiral of land values destroyed Jay Golden's prosperity as well as his hopes of financial freedom. He declared bankruptcy in 1899, the last general authority to do so. After the death of Heber C. Kimball in 1868, Jay Golden's widowed mother took her two sons and a daughter, that's Elias and Mary Margaret, and Golden to a ranch above Bear Lake. It's in Round Valley, if any of you know that part of the state. For the next 15 years, Golden and his brother Elias worked tirelessly, lived frugally, and achieved some measure of financial security. Golden served in the Southern States Mission from April 1883 to April of 1885, and Elias followed him into the mission field. Golden married Jenny Knowlton of Kaysville in 1887, and soon afterwards they moved to Kaysville, where he and Elias acquired a considerable amount of real estate. In 1891, Wilford Woodruff called Golden as president of the Southern States Mission, and 15 months later appointed him as a member of the First Council of 70, where he remained for the rest of his life. When he died at 85, he was president of the First Council of 70. He succeeded B.H. Roberts in that position. Elias replaced Golden as a mission president in the Southern States in the fall of 1894. At the time, Golden was 41 and had been married for 7 years. It was becoming increasingly apparent to him that his family's financial future lay under a dark cloud. Jay Golden Kimball was one of thousands of men who found themselves in desperate straits as the Panic of 1893 swept across the nation. His resulting impoverishment defined his circumstances for the rest of his life. To present Golden Kimball as a man of lighthearted humor and irreverent observations, as I have done over the past two decades, is an excessively narrow view. It does a great disservice to this honorable, dedicated, unpretentious man who struggled all of his life to provide even a marginal standard of living for his family. In his diary entries on the 7th and 8th of September 1896, Golden recalls how he and his brother Elias were first drawn into investing in real estate. Our hearts had been set upon getting rich. We saw the great prestige it gave men in the world and also amongst Latter-day Saints. Seeing this, we were determined to get rich. And at this time, property being of high value, Elias and I were worth about $40,000 to $50,000 in real estate. At one time, I took and made a balance sheet and inventory, and we found that we had $4 worth of property for every dollar we owed. It was not long after that that the money became very scarce, and we owed $4 for every $1 we had in real estate. We were being oppressed to pay off mortgages, and having paid so much in interest, taxes, and expenses, the canker worm had eaten the vitals out of our business. Our imaginary riches, as they had proved to be, commenced to slip through our fingers, and had it not been for the books in which we kept our records and accounts, we would have felt we had been robbed. Contemporaries refer to this crisis as the Cleveland Depression because Grover Cleveland was president of the United States at the time. But in fact, it was a global financial crisis. The failure of Barings Bank in London, its first failure, led directly to a crisis of credit in the United States. It swept across the Atlantic because London at that time was the financial capital of the world, in which banks were unable to make loans to their customers. From 1893 to 1894, more than 800 American banks closed their doors. As the crisis continued for another 3 years, it left about one out of every five in the country's non-agricultural workers unemployed. The economy of Utah was based on agriculture, mining, and transportation, precisely the three economic sectors hardest hit by the Depression. Mine closures were so common that by 1984, production of silver in Utah had fallen by 33%, production of copper, 48%, production of salt, a staggering 92%. Utah's high birth rate and heavy immigration only compounded the problem. By the spring of 1894, it was estimated that 4,349 of the 9,000 working men in Salt Lake City were unemployed, just a little less than half. In the summer of 1893, church finances were paralyzed. At that point, Golden left Chattanooga, where he was the mission president, and returned to Salt Lake City by train. Desperate for funds to maintain the Southern States mission, as he told President Wilford Woodruff, he was, quote, at the end of my rope, end of quote, and he pleaded for anything that might be available. However, there were simply no funds to be had. 4 weeks later, he returned to the mission field as destitute as he had when he left the mission field. In his diary, Golden complained repeatedly that money is tight and that it is impossible to sell land. However, it seems to have had little, understanding of the complex factors that gave rise to the Depression. Quote, flour, meat, dry goods are increasing in price, he lamented. And for the life of me, I cannot see any reason for it. This is 30 April, 1898. Golden viewed the national economic crisis in personal terms, blaming himself for seeking wealth, for coveting prestige, and for not paying a strict tithe. It is hardly surprising then that he also personally blamed the men who stood above him in the chain of economic failures. Foremost among these men was John W. Taylor, the handsome, energetic, and charismatic son of President John Taylor. John W. was ordained an apostle at the age of 25. He was married to six attractive, vivacious women and eventually sired 36 children. He had many admirers, and they regarded him as prophetic, visionary, and hardworking, a born leader. However, he had equally numerous detractors who felt that he was a fast-talking huckster, a man who invariably lived beyond his means. In 1887, Taylor traveled to southern Alberta, where he was overwhelmed by the abundant natural resources of that province. According to Samuel Taylor, his son and biographer, John W. viewed this virgin wilderness as a perfect haze, quote, as a perfect haven for the oppressed saints of the United States, a raw land awaiting development, end of quote. When he returned to Salt Lake City, his son recalled he lived, slept, and ate Canada. He breathed Canada, in and out of church. Here's a quote, you can buy land in Canada for 60 cents an acre, he assured the credulous Mormons in Salt Lake City, end of quote. And at the time, and the time will come, he said, when you can sell it for $25 an acre, $50 an acre, and yes, even $100 an acre, end of quote. Hundreds of church members invested in Taylor's Alberta Land and Colonization Company, including Jay Golden and his brother Elias. Together they raised $7,000 in cash and signed banknotes for another $7,000, enough to purchase 19,000 acres of the Canadian wilderness. Golden let his diary lapse in the early 1890s, but he resumed his entries on January the 1st, 1895. His second entry, he shares the perspective on the plight Jay Golden that John W. Taylor had created for him and for Elias. Soon after breakfast, quote,
Soon after breakfast, Sheriff Fred Turner served a summons on me. Orange J. Salisbury was suing E.Z. Stewart, Elias S. Kimmel, and J. Golden Kimmel to obtain judgment against us for $3,500 and 10% interest from May 7, 1892 to May. And from May 7, 1892 and 10% attorney fees in case of suit. This note is one of the notes we agreed to endorse for John W. Taylor. He signed the note as endorser and left the names, the rest of the names blank. He's put his names in these blank spaces and went on to, goes into elaborate manipulation of money and stock. I won't read all that, but he says, the above trouble, although of long lasting, caused me very bad feelings. I confess I'm afraid of poverty. I'm more fearful of being brought in disrepute for what we are now unable to pay in terms of our debts. I have concluded to do our best to contest the notes, but will not bring accusations against Taylor, but will leave the matter to the Lord. It's very interesting that he and Taylor always had a very amicable relationship. They often traveled together in church assignments, and the issue was never addressed. A few months later, Golden wrote despondently to Barnes Banking Company of Kaysville, quote, already threatened us with foreclosure on our farm of 630 acres unless we pay all interest due amounting to over $300 on the $5,000 note which is past due. This we cannot do, so the inevitable must come. This worries me and makes me grow old and cross. My feelings cannot be described. This is 2 to 5 December, 1895. The judgment went against Golden and Elias. They appealed, and the case dragged on for nearly five more years. Golden never doubted that John W. Taylor was responsible for plunging them into a financial nightmare, and he was equally certain that the bank was unjustified in seeking repayment. On 1st of April, 1899, when he realized that the appeal was not going to be ruled in their favor, he made a painful decision to declare bankruptcy. Quite defiantly, he wrote, quote, I owe no grocery bills or merchandise, no widows or fatherless. We gave up 3,000 head of cattle and a chattel mortgage on them to pay the $3,500 notes, and we feel we have paid those notes. I have no compunctions in doing so, and my conscience does not hurt me in this matter. 1 April, 1899. 19 days later, he signed an affidavit, later filed with the U.S. District Court in Utah, in which he placed his assets at $2,301 and his debts at $11,126. How did Golden and his family survive through this desperate period? First, Golden owned a small house on the west side of Salt Lake City, which he rented for $4 a month. At one point, when he feared that this property might be seized by his creditors, he moved his family into the house and claimed it was his primary residence. Second, Golden was forced to sell the livestock he owned in Cache Valley, as well as his mining stock and his additional pieces of property. Most of the funds he obtained from these sales went to pay taxes and attorney fees. Third, he received $100 a month from the church as an appropriation or stipend. Golden collected this money in person on the first working day of each month from James Jack, secretary to the First Presidency. On 9 April 1899, this stipend was raised to $125 a month, one-third paid in cash and one-third in scrip from the tithing office. On several occasions, Golden noted that he had to go back twice to collect the full amount. Golden was not the only general authority who received a monthly allowance of this kind. Appropriations were a regular item on the agenda of the Council of 70, although at least some of the time they seem to have been reimbursements for travel expenses. Apparently, he began receiving an allowance in the fall of 1894, certainly before he resumed keeping his diary, since in January 1895 he mentioned paying a doctor's bill with tithing coupons, meaning scrip, issued by the church tithing office. Evidently, he was running an account at the tithing office because he records having to go there as well as to several other businesses in town asking that they be patient with us because we could not pay them at the present. This is 15 March, 1895. A year later, he wrote, quote, desire to say that I am not a salaried man, but when I make requests, receive appropriations to assist me. Received no money but tithing office scrip, which is not at par, and could only get produce and meats of all kinds. I managed to exist, but not sumptuously. End of quote. 11 March, 1896. During the territorial era, according to Leonard Arrington, the local and central tithing offices functioned, quote, as community warehouses, general stores, banks, weighing stations, relief and employment agencies, and communication centers. End of quote. The tithing storehouse still served as a sort of general store during the 1890s. In his diary, Golden notes that he purchased the following items there: lumber for a fence, hay for the horse and cow, coal, firewood, flour, meat, potatoes, corn, melons, honey, grapes, and other produce. Although this list of available produce seems impressive, at other times the shelves were nearly bare. In August of 1898, when the fresh produce should have been in abundance, quote, Golden recorded bitterly at 9 a.m., went to the tithing office to get something to eat. Could only get flour and meat. Favoritism is manifest to quite an extent. It makes me tired to be under the necessity of feeding at the corn crib. Any of you with rural backgrounds know what a corn crib is. I was not educated to it. I am desperately unhappy. I cannot overcome it. I am helpless. 17 August, 1898. It would be interesting to examine J. Golden Kimball's account of the tithing office books, but apparently the ledgers for this period are not extant. Tithing office script did not necessarily circulate at par, and some merchants were reluctant to accept it at all. More than once, Golden's records for paying items, partly in tithing script and partly in cash. When he needed to buy a new stove, he went to Rulon S. Wells, also a member of the Council of 70, at the Cooperative Wagon and Machine Company. Golden noted gratefully that Wells kindly consented to take tithing office script and let him pay $67 balance over the next 6 months period. Many local establishments only accepted the tithing at a steep discount. Golden does not always specify the items, but typically the discount seems to have been about 30%. For example, although ZCMI accepted $30 of the tithing script from Golden, he only received $20 in credit for it, 17 May 1895. In one particularly clever transaction, when Golden owed $152.40 to the Utah Mercantile Company, he arranged with the proprietor, Jesse W. Fox, Jr., to pay Jesse's tithing with script that he borrowed from the Improvement Era office and then repay in $25 installments the amount for the stove. In 29th of December, 1898, another occasion, he bought two tickets to Sault Ayre for tithing off the script and then sold them for cash. Golden also borrowed money occasionally from the office of the Council of the 70, usually in the form of tithing script. As Golden's desperation increased, he began to contemplate the humiliating step of appealing to the First Presidency for direct aid. In June of 1896, he approached Joseph F. Smith, who told him to apply formally for aid. After more than a year, when nothing came of this application, Golden reluctantly presented his case to George Q. Cannon, then First Counselor in the First Presidency. He described, quote, "We have been ruined by Apostle John W. Taylor, and that we had lost all of our earthly possessions," end of quote. Cannon not only said that he was, quote, "very sorry," but also instructed James Jack to provide one-third of Golden's $100 stipend in cash. This essentially giving the beleaguered 70 one-third more purchasing power. "I felt very grateful indeed," Golden noted. Unfortunately, it was not enough. The next year, on the 30th of November, 1898, Golden went to the First Presidency office, quote, "with the intention of asking President Snow for an appropriation of $500. Heber J. Grant and John Henry Smith advised him that his request was ill-timed. The church was trying to float a bond to pay off some of its own debt. Quote, "and if I made a request now, I would be refused, so I came away and said nothing," end of quote. Grant and Smith were not exaggerating the precarious state of the church's finances. In fact, the previous month, when Golden arrived to collect his allowance, James Jack had to scrape together from, quote, $33.35 cash, $6.65 meat orders, and $66 in tithing script for October 1898. At this point, Golden's long-suffering but spirited wife, Jenny, intervened. Seizing a time in December when Golden was out of town, he was in the southern states, going to conferences, she called on President Lorenzo Snow and, quote, "made a statement of my circumstances and how difficult it was for me to get along, as I was $200 behind on account of doctor bills, store accounting improvements, lawsuits, and children," end of quote. Snow asked Jenny to tell her husband to call on him at home. 2 days after Christmas, Golden did so. Snow candidly confessed that, quote, "the church owed $1.5 million. But promised to increase Golden's stipend to $125 a month for a while at any rate, 27 December 1898. 2 years later, on 20 September 1901, Golden again pled his financial case to President Snow. The President, quote, "without hesitancy," end of quote, authorized an appropriation of $1,000, easing Golden's embarrassment with the assurance, quote, "I know of no man that I would prefer helping, and I do it on account of your father," end of quote. Although Golden continued to struggle financially for the rest of his life, he did not, to my knowledge, have to ask the First Presidency to ever bail him out again. He conscientiously paid a strict tithing, declaring bankruptcy had unburdened him from a crushing debt, and in January of 1900, he finally gained full-time employment as Secretary of the First Council of 70. Although he bitterly resented the inevitable blurring of his role, his modest salary of $75 a month, one-fifth in tithing script, was very important in bridging the financial chasm over which he and his family dangled. What were the personal consequences for J. Golden Kimball and his bruising passage through the Panic of 1893 and its aftermath? Although these conclusions are tentative, I'd like to suggest four. First, Golden felt a sense of personal powerlessness, coupled with a stinging sense of personal culpability. He attributed his financial woes to his pride, to his failure to pay his tithing on a property transaction in Salt Lake City, and to the deceit of John W. Taylor, and to the unchristian greed of the banks with which he had taken out loans. In one agonizing entry in 1897, beleaguered by a lawsuit and stripped of resources, he wrote, "This is particularly poignant. Now listen to this." He says, "Have no home, can make no improvements in temporal things. I sometimes feel like I had fallen into a whirlpool and was going round and round instead of straight ahead. To be in debt, have judgment hanging over you, and to be sold out of all earthly possessions and robbed of your heritage, and although an apostle of the Lord, is almost more than my human nature can endure. We are dependent and helpless, feeding at the church crib. It is true, I am laboring in this ministry and have been blessed far beyond my expectations, yet it is contrary to my nature to be dependent on others. Cannot seek for employment unless I give up my labors in spiritual matters, and to do that means spiritual death. Being away from home leaves all the burden of caring for my five helpless children upon my wife. She swelters under her load and complains. That makes me desperate. And so taking all in all, except when I do enjoy the Spirit of the Lord, this life is hell, for I am a slave in a rice swamp when it comes to temporary matters. My struggle in life at the present is to trust in the Lord, believing after I have paid the penalty of my transgression, the Lord will rescue me from my difficulties. I am suffering my just deserts. And while I do not suffer patiently and uncomplainingly, yet I pray to my Father, that I might not lose eternal life. I leave this confession as an object lesson for my posterity, and may it live after me. And if they do desire the same unhappy experience, let them try the same experience, and let them also learn obedience through these things which they suffer, or else rebel against the Lord and harden their hearts and go straight to hell. 4 November 1897. A second personal consequence arose from Golden's lack of understanding of the large national economic forces that drove him into bankruptcy. As a result, he developed a perpetual fearful outlook. Golden harped unendingly on the need to economize at home, and he seems to have had little talent for finding opportunities for fun with the family's limited budget. Although Golden was willing to take the children for drives, he tried to squelch projects that involved cash, such as outings or to the circus or to Salt Air. One New Year's Day, when Jenny arranged for the children to go to a theater matinee, Golden flared up, quote, "I am of the old school and do not believe children should go out too much and become dissatisfied and discontented, as we cannot keep it up. Being of poor circumstances, the children went, of course. I was outgeneraled and was hot about it," end of quote, 1 January 1898. At least occasionally, the children probably felt that their father was miserly. Similarly, because the family could not afford to hire a maid, Golden tried to help Jenny with household chores. However, his assistance was so grudgingly and resentfully given, as he acknowledged himself, that Jenny must have asked for his help only as a last resort. A third consequence of Golden's bruising experience of the Panic of 1893, combined with his bankruptcy and his calling as a general authority, is that he remained on the edge financially for the rest of his life. He was either unable or unwilling to find supplemental work until he was hired as a secretary to the First Council of 70. The results of Golden's first venture in seeking riches were so disastrous that he may have been subconsciously afraid to ever make even a second attempt. A fourth consequence, perhaps the most serious, was the additional strain that poverty put on the Kimball marriage. Golden idealized his mother. She was sweet, submissive, spiritual, and adoring. Jenny was not sweet or submissive. Both she and Golden were hot-tempered, And they might have had a trying relationship even under affluent circumstances. Jenny was fun-loving, spontaneous, sociable, and independent, genuine strengths, but traits which frequently brought her into conflict with Golden. Quite often when Golden and Jenny quarreled, Golden would storm out of the house and buy breakfast or lunch at a downtown cafe. Given his feelings about the virtues of thrift, it seems clear that this was a way of punishing Jenny by frivolously spending their limited funds. In summary, Golden Kimball entered a decade of the 1890s as a hardworking, prosperous rancher and farmer with a young wife, the beginnings of a family, and an important and satisfying calling in the church. He ended the decade bankrupt, humiliated, with too much free time on his hands, full of chronic anxiety about money, and with a frequent and pleasant pattern of relating to his family. But he also emerged with an enormous sympathy for those saints who were struggling with similar problems, with a dogged determination to persevere under his heavy burdens, and on good days, with the ability to regard his predicament with wry humor that became his trademark. That's an interesting comment, because I often think if Golden had become financially solvent, he may not have developed this human touch or his wit, because the pulpit became his refuge. That was where he was himself. That was where he knew his greatest happiness. And he probably would have been forgotten in the annals of church history today, except that he had to rely on his own wit and his own human touch as money continued to elude him. People expressing their personal appreciation for Golden often said, "Brother Kimball, there will never be another like you in the church." With a wry smile, he would reply, "Thank you. I'm sure that must be a great source of comfort to all the brethren." I'll tell you this story. Jack Gallivan, who was the publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune, who followed John Fitzpatrick. Fitzpatrick was publisher of the Tribune from 1924 to 1960, and then John Gallivan became publisher. And as a young man, Gallivan had been adopted into the Tribune family, the Kearns family. And he said that he would once a month drive up to the church office building, pick up Golden Kimball and bring him down to the Tribune and take him up to the executive offices on the 8th or 9th floor. And he and Mr. Fitzpatrick would have lunch together. And he said he'd sit in the outer office and listen to them tell stories and laugh. And he said, "I distinctly remember once when Mr. Fitzpatrick said to Golden, 'Now, Golden, we're in the depths of the Great Depression. I can't imagine that you have enough money to pay a 10% tithing. Come on, Golden, you can tell me the truth. You can't be paying tithing on what little they pay you.'" And Uncle Golden said, "Hell no, I don't pay tithing. I don't make 10%. And they laughed and laughed and laughed. Well, that concludes my paper. It's now 4:05, so if you have any questions, I would attempt to field them, or we can turn it over for commentary. Do you have any questions, ladies and gentlemen?
The commentary first, and then we can hear some more stories.
Okay.
I'm not going to be too long.
Okay, go right ahead.
Many of you probably came to hear some of the funny stories. This is kind of depressing, isn't it? One of the most difficult things to teach in an American history course is how desperate people were in the Great Depression. Almost none of us lived through it, and we can hardly empathize with those who did. But you know some of them, and they've never recovered from it as far as insecurity. In my opinion, and I'm accused of living back in the 1890s, more than 100 years ago, that was a worse one in several ways. One was human suffering. There wasn't any kind of welfare agency to take care of those who were starving. There wasn't even a government agency to keep track of who was starving. There were some ministers who recorded people freezing to death and starving to death in New York City. We didn't have people freeze to death and starve to death in the Depression of the 1930s when Uncle Golden was secure enough to not have to worry about starvation, and can he really even joke about his tithing? That depression of the 90s was the worst we'd ever had up until that time, up until the 1930s. And it hit Utah probably harder than most places. It's the only time in the history of the church when they couldn't meet their own payroll. And they supported two banks that were on the verge of going broke. Maybe you've heard of Heber M. Wells. He's the first governor of the state. He was a cashier of one of those banks and was Heber J. Grant's brother-in-law. And Grant was something of a financier who was trying to save the church and, in fact, did come up with some loans during that difficult time that saved those two banks. My hero, my old professor from BYU, accused me of this in his book review in Journal of American History on political deliverance. Dick Paul said that I adopted George Q. Cannon as my hero. He was Wilford Woodruff's counselor in the first presidency, and along with other brethren saw how terrible it was. Jim mentioned that almost half those in non-agricultural jobs in the Salt Lake County were unemployed. And a lot of these are really ambitious, capable people who wanted to work. In Jay Golden's quorum, they weren't discussing this, but they sure were in the quorum of the 12 and in the quorum of the first presidency. And one of their main goals was to gain and secure and maintain control of the resources of the Intermountain West and try and get some people working by promoting some industries. And the plan, and it was very controversial, was to secure some financing from outside. They tried first a guy some of you have heard of because I've preached about him so much, Isaac Trumbull, and he failed in 1893. And then there's a Utah company in 1894 headed by a guy from New York City named Purbeck. But the guy that did it, and it's amazing how little he's known, although he's mentioned in Leonard Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom, is a guy named Joseph Bannigan, 1895 to 98, who loaned the church enterprises money to the tune of several million dollars to promote railroads and coal mines in Summit and Iron County. And they tried a Utah-Idaho sugar company, or what became that, and Utah Power and Light, or what became that. And most of those enterprises didn't work, but two of them did, the sugar and the electric power. And that was enough, in my opinion, to get the church out of debt. Jim mentioned that Lorenzo Snow mentioned that the church was in debt $1.5 million. And that's exactly how much he mentioned in the paper they were trying to sell bonds for. Those programs that George Q. Cannon pushed with the consent of the prophet, Wilford Woodruff, were working when Woodruff died. And when Lorenzo Snow, who was against the church being in these things, came to power. But he had no choice but to try and get the church out of debt by selling these bonds. And in fact, it worked. I have done some writing, and I think it'll come out soon in Journal of Mormon History, that says the next three prophets, Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, and Heber J. Grant, were against this, but it worked. There's no way George Q. Cannon's ever going to get the credit, because those brethren are going to be the prophets for the next 50 years. I'm trying to give Cannon some credit now for what he did to try and solve the problems that Jay Golden's life shows so well. Jim mentioned that the church made sure no general authority ever went bankrupt again. And there were some people who were subsidized quite heavily after that, and the salary certainly got better after the tithing script. I'm preoccupied right now with a trip to Italy in 3 weeks. I'm going to be seeing some Verdi operas, which is my favorite thing in the whole world. But I know of another guy named Pagliacci. Do you know him? The clown who is really sadder than anybody in the audience. I can see a parallel with J. Golden Kimball. especially after this paper. And I understand and totally agree with what Jim says about he's more sensitive because he suffered. I'm named for a guy named Edward Leo Lyman, who had two sawmills in Millard County burn during this period of time. He had bought them both from Consolidated Wagon and Machine, a Mormon company. He had a choice between going bankrupt and, horror of horrors, moving to the city and working for half pay while the other half went to pay off that debt. He raised his kids in Ogden. His overweight daughter wore boys' shoes because the girls' shoes wore out too fast. They were known as Millie's shoes. It was a joke among the kids that this girl had to wear boys' shoes. The kids my great-grandfather's kids hated it up there. And the sad thing is, just when he got the debt paid and moved back to my ancestral home of Oak City, he was digging a grave and got pneumonia and died young, leaving those kids without a dad. And so the poverty continued. It's this depression that Jay Golden didn't understand, and I doubt if hardly anybody in Utah did, including maybe Lorenzo Snow. I appreciate Jim's paper. I see no flaws in the picture he tells of an individual life. A flawed life in some ways. He wasn't a very fun father. He may have been somebody that could keep you awake in conference, but he's a tightwad. When it comes, his poor wife. And it's no wonder some of those kids blamed the church a little bit for some of the suffering they went through. I'm grateful that Jim's doing this project. This is not a well-known general authority, because he isn't involved in politics, he isn't involved in finances. He's a legend in his humor, and we all know that. And now we can see the other side of him too. He's more human. Maybe he's more appreciated. I would rather have you ask Jim questions about this stuff, but if you have any questions on this depressing subject of the depression, I can answer some too. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have this microphone available for any questions from the audience. You can use this. Remember, this is being taped, isn't it?
Yes.
And so you should speak into the microphone so that they hear the questions also.
Thank you.
Unless Jim can repeat the question.
I'll repeat it, Toby, if you want to just... It's totally up to you.
What was this script? That's sort of a new concept to me, with church issuing its own money.
Yeah.
Maybe you can
money.
Elaborate on that. And then second, again, what was the... What Jay Golden was called to be... When he's called to be a mission president, was he prosperous?
No.
He was then. Reasonably.
Yeah, reasonably. He wasn't as poor as he was later, but it was it's a relative thing.
Okay, but then when he was called to be general authority, less prosperous?
Yeah.
Was he in bankruptcy then, or was he...
1899, he filed bankruptcy, and he was called 1893 to be a general authority.
The depression didn't start until 93, so he still got some prosperity. They're not going to hold that against him.
Yeah. But let me tell you about tithing script. As I understand it, there was no federal money. You see, we were not in the union. This man knows the struggle we had to get in the union. But it wasn't until we got into the union in 1896 that federal money began to be issued in the West. This tithing script was just a substitute. You can still, if you go to some coin shops, you can still find, although it's expensive now, some of the old Mormon tithing script. It was produced out of Chicago on very high-quality paper and beautifully engraved. But... if they gave you $30 worth of tithing script, it wasn't at par value. You would be lucky to get $20 out of it, Tobe. But it was a medium of exchange that existed here for a short period of time.
Your
yes, you could pay your tithing with tithing.
That's the trick he pulled using Brother Fox.
Yeah. He paid Brother Fox's tithing in full and got full credit and then paid him back $65 a month for Sun Pine. Any rate, it was... statehood was something... I won't go into this because this is this gentleman's subject and Brother Lyman's subject, but I tell you that it was a godsend when they finally got into the Union because it meant a great deal of stability to the economy. It meant more increased trade. It meant federal troops out here to protect the frontier forts. See, most of the state, 73% of the state, belonged to the federal government anyway. When they arrived here, it was Mexican territory, if you'll recall, in 1847. Then in January of 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo then gave it to the United States because they lost the war with Mexico. But those are some of the fundamental things. And I think that... a theocracy existed here until we came into the Union. And that was the thing they were most hesitant about, was limiting the power of the governor, because they knew the first governor would be Brigham Young. So, at any rate, it plays into a very interesting and a grand accommodation between the church and the federal government. Anyway, yes, sir.
I'm very curious about the amount of guilt that Jay Golden carried around about his lack of economic success and so forth. Do you want to comment about that?
Well, let me just tell you that Golden's son, Jack Kimball, wrote a wonderful piece that I put in a Journal of Mormon History article. And he said that all of his life, his father suffered from an intense inferiority complex. And he said that he felt this had come from the fact that he'd never succeeded. I think all men, to a greater or lesser degree, feel that they haven't succeeded financially. It affects them. It affects their self-image, where men who make enormous amounts of money never struggle with that very much in terms of self-esteem. It's just part of the testosterone, I think. Yes, sir.
Another part of it, Mel. When he made one of those real estate deals that made some money, he didn't pay his tithing on it. And he felt guilty about that and felt this suffering was penance for at least 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Tremendous guilt about that. Tremendous guilt about that. I think it was just that he was strapped. He had so many bills to pay that he took that money, according to his diary, and simply paid the bills because they were pounding on his door. He had a grocer beat him up on the streets one night. Brass knuckles. And he was put in the hospital for 2 weeks with facial injuries about the head and neck because he owed him $27. Can you believe? He was a general authority at the time. What didn't appear in the Deseret News appeared only in the Tribune. Yes, sir. I'll repeat your question. Go ahead, sir. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a capitalistic society. It really is. It's hard to deal with. I mean, I deal with it myself. I mean, the question was, isn't it a part of our culture, a part of our capitalistic culture, for men to feel that kind of guilt? I mean, I'm around... many, many friends now who have all their mortgages paid off. I don't. I'm 66. I don't have my mortgage paid. I think, what have I done with my life? You see. Yes, sir. Okay, the question to me is, John W. Taylor, how did he take advantage of all the people that invested in his Canada project? My understanding of it, and there's two sides to the story, is that John W. Taylor lost as much as everybody else did. He thought the scheme would work. But when they invested all that money, it was a universal depression. It just didn't affect the United States. It affected land values all over the world, Australia, England, the United States, Mexico. And the value of the land went south. And so they all lost their money. And John W. Taylor was later excommunicated from the church.
Not for that.
Not for that. No, no. Thank you. But he was excommunicated. He was a tragic figure in Mormon history. But he sure knew how to pick women. You should see his wives. They were knockouts. Every one of them. Yes, sir. I don't know.
He came close a lot of times. I don't think he ever did it. I don't think so.
I don't think he ever did either.
I think he got bailed out more times than Jay Golden did.
Pardon me? Oh, yes, yeah, he was impacted. But you see, Jay Golden was the last general authority to ever declare bankruptcy. John W. Taylor was bailed out because they went around and paid off his debts 10 cents on the dollar. So John W. Taylor didn't have to file bankruptcy, but he got in trouble in another.
Jim, Ronald Walker, who's a biographer of Peter J. Grant, wrote a classic article in Arizona in the West magazine, republished in Sunstone, on Heber J. and the Panic of 93 and how he basically saved the church, at least temporarily. My man, Heber J., or George Q. Cannon, went clear to England. He was a personal friend of the prime minister at the time, who was a son-in-law of Baron Rothschild's, the biggest banker in the world. Heber J. Grant and George Q. Cannon tried to get church loans from the Rothschild's banks, but failed. But Heber was big in saving the church, even though he personally and Cannon were not paying all of their debts either. But there wasn't any bankruptcy in either family, I don't believe.
No. To my knowledge, no. Okay, listen, we've got... May I just add a footnote here? Leo, my recollection of that Ron Walker piece, and you should get it and read it. I mean, it just captivates you. You can't set it down about how he was back in New York walking the streets trying to find someone to take the stock of ZCMI as collateral and loan them money. And he finally found some Jewish bankers, as I recall, and they gave him the money and came out here eventually and looked over ZCMI and looked at the stock. And he raised not a great deal of money, but enough to get us over one more crisis, and then George Q. Cannon helped with others. But it was a miraculous thing to me that these men were able to salvage, because the church, I think there was something like $8,700 in Zion Bank, and that was it. They had no more money left. Anyway, I'll tell you this story. I'll finish on this, because you patiently came and patiently listened.
Time for some humor.
And time for some humor. This story just came to me a month ago. I was out seeing a doctor, and a man came up to me and said, "You're Golden Kimball, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, in a real sense, I am. I've taken on his persona, and my wife doesn't even know who I am anymore, but I've taken on his persona so much." And he said, "I got to tell you this story." He said, "My dad lived in his ward, the old 18th ward, up on the avenues. He lived right across from the now restored McCune mansion. The driveway comes down, and if you look just a little bit to the east, that's where Golden lived, in that little white house with a small porch." And he said, "My dad taught the gospel doctrine class," and I don't know that they called it that in those days, but he said, "Golden would on occasion come to Sunday school." And he says, "My dad was teaching this class this day, and Golden comes hobbling in. Here he is in his 84th birthday, and his 84th year, and he comes in and sits down on the back row. And he says, "My father was teaching the concept of forgiveness, forgiving your enemies." And he went on and on about how we have to, if we don't forgive our enemies, then we have the greater sin, which is clearly illustrated in the New Testament and the Doctrine and Covenants. And then he said something very interesting to the audience. He said, "How many of you have forgiven all your enemies? How many of you?" And nobody raised their hand. He says, "How many of you have more than 100 enemies you haven't forgiven?" And a few people raised their hands. And he said, "How many of you have more than 50? And more hands went up. And he said, "More than 25, fewer hands. And finally he said, "How many of you have forgiven everyone? You have no enemies." Golden Kimball raised his hand. One hand was up. And he says, "Brother Kimball, you have no enemies? You have forgiven them all?" There was silence. And he says, "Come up and tell us, Brother Kimball, how you've been able to do this. We all would like to learn from you." And so Golden comes up.
And he said, well, brothers and sisters, it's not a very complicated thing. I just outlived all the sons of bitches.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for both of you for your very insightful presentations.